Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Tony Award-winning scenic designer Beowulf Borrett received his third Tony nomination last month for his design for the Roundabout Theatre Company production of Thérèse Raquin. His previous designs for Broadway include Rock of Ages, Sondheim on Sondheim, The Scottsboro Boys, Chaplin, and Act One, for which he won his Tony Award. He also designed the 25th annual Putnam County Spelling Bee and On the Town at Barrington Stage in Pittsfield, moving those designs to Broadway. He'll return to Barrington Stage Company this summer, designing the set for the Pirates of Penzance. Beowulf Borrett, welcome to the Roundtable.
Hi, I'm thrilled to be here.
So first things first, of course, congratulations on your Tony nomination.
Thanks. It was a surprise, honestly. The show closed ages ago. I keep saying it closed 6 years ago, but that's not quite true.
It must feel that way.
It sort of does. It was last year, and it feels like forever ago, and I really, genuinely did not think I would get remembered at awards season, and it was a very, very pleasant surprise when it happened.
So before we talk about that set specifically, the set for Thérèse Raquin, I would like to ask you how you came to this career. When did you discover theater design, production design was something you could do, and how did you go about pursuing it?
I was an artsy kid. I drew lots of pictures from when I was a small child, and I did the school play in elementary school and that kind of thing. When I was a junior in high school in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, after my junior year, we lived in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, and there was a summer stock theater at the local college, and my parents encouraged me, or I wanted to do it, and my parents let me do it for the summer. And it was mostly college students. I was the one high school kid. But it's when I first, there was a set designer there, and it's the first time I really realized there was such a thing as set design, that there was a job someone could have. And I sort of think that's when I knew I wanted to do it. The next year, I convinced people at my high school to let me do the set for the school play. And when I was looking for colleges, I started really kind of looking for a theater program, looking for a program that had some kind of design emphasis, because I thought it might be something I wanted to do. I had no idea I was going to go into it professionally. I thought I'd be a design professor somewhere. But that was sort of the beginning of it.
As a designer, when you attend the theater, do you watch the set more than the performance? Is it something you observe differently than other people would?
I probably do. It's certainly a professional hazard. It's funny. My wife's an actor, and she always says, no matter how good the play is, if the set is bad, I'm probably not going to enjoy it, or I'm going to like it less. And so I think there is some truth to that. If the design is interesting, it will carry me through a play that maybe isn't as good. Mm-hmm. And if the design is boring, I will maybe not like a play that is very good as much. But hopefully I can still appreciate the other parts of it too. But there certainly is a hazard there.
Set design can be anything, as you know better than I do. There's so many different things that it can be, traditional things, but just anything, like anything at all. How do you, when you receive a project, decide what that anything will be and pursue the design for that show, for that production?
Honestly, what I do is, I'll read the play, but I will sit down and talk with the director, because the director has to be the guiding force behind everything. And if the director doesn't have sort of a strong sense of not how things should look, but how they should feel, it's harder to do it. As long as the director has it's a sense of feeling is really what I'm after, and we can talk about that, then I can come up with how it should look. But honestly, how it looks is almost secondary to me. What I'm really interested in is figuring out what's sort of the themes that we're trying to bring out, what's the arc of the story, and how can I visually represent that? And maybe that's some kind of realistic thing, like a room on stage, or maybe it's something totally abstract. And really what it is in a lot of what I do, and the stuff that I seem to get hired for more and more, is I change space a lot. And it can be realistic spaces changing or abstract spaces changing, but it's a stage space that's sort of changing and morphing over the course of the play. And I've started kind of thinking of set design as a transformation of space over time. And sometimes the transition is dramatic, sometimes it's subtle, sometimes it's fast, sometimes it's slow, sometimes you're not even aware of it happening until after it's happened. But all of that sort of ties into the pace of the play and how the story is being told. And if I'm lucky, it all works out that sort of the high points in the design, the visual moments that are exciting or shocking or whatever they are, line up with the high points in the story. So at the climactic moments of the story, you're sort of punctuating those with the visuals. And that, I think, leads to good kind of theatrical storytelling.
That was so wonderfully put, I barely know what to say back to you.
Thank you. Thank you.
But I'll
my
come
head
up...
is swelling up so big that the earphones are going to pop off.
I'll come up with something, though. It's my job. So when you met with Evan Cabinet to talk about Thérèse Raquin, what was that feeling you had to capture?
Yeah, it's what's interesting is I had never worked with Evan before. Todd Hames, who's the artistic director of the Roundabout, connected us. And so our first meeting was my interview for the job. But we had a great meeting. We sat in the lobby of the Intercontinental, and we just talked for, I think, like an hour and a half. I had brought along a book of some paintings by a Danish painter named Wilhelm Hammershøi. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that has nothing to do with France or Thérèse Raquin, but it felt like the right mood to me. And I showed it to Evan. He was like, yeah, that's it. That's right. There are these really kind of beautiful but bleak, like just you just want to like cry for these poor people in this horrible, bleached out, bleak world mm-hmm. in these paintings. And it felt like the emotional world of Thérèse Raquin. And the other important thing that came up in our first talk is that the climactic moment of Thérèse Raquin is when she drowns her husband in the river. And we were saying, well, what if we did a real river? I'd seen a couple of productions of the story in different forms, and it was always like a rowboat on wheels that sort of went around the stage, and they figured out some way to stage a drowning. And the prospect of doing it with real water really excited me. And in general, I'm actually not a fan of realism on stage, and in fact, the Thérèse set was basically not very realistic. But the water was real, and the rowboat was real, and they could really row the boat across the stage and really throw a guy in the water, and he seemed to really drown. It was some clever staging, so we didn't have to go through an actor a day. But he disappeared under the water, and you didn't see him come back up again.
No, he didn't. It does make it – I saw the production, and it does make it very tense because, you know, all the safety – precautions have been taken for this to happen 8 shows a week, but it feels really dangerous.
That was the joy of it. And it just the actual physical motion of a boat behaving as it does in water is sort of exciting on stage because I've never seen it before. I'm sure somebody's done it before. I don't think I'm the first to do it, but it's not something you see often. And so there was an excitement just to that. And when we got to that part of the play every night, you could sort of feel the audience say, oh my God, that's an actual river, because they'd seen it, but I think everyone assumed it was 2 inches deep until suddenly there's a boat rowing around in it.
Mm-hmm. Once you know you want to accomplish that, who do you have to work with, or how do you figure out the technical aspects of doing it, of getting water, of getting a river into the theater?
Yeah, it's tricky. And I actually had some history with water and the Roundabout Theater before. I did a show off-Broadway with them that Jake Gyllenhaal was in a couple years ago where we did water, mm-hmm. and it had not gone well. We had leaked badly and actually ruined the theater downstairs from us in the process.
Oh, no.
So it was a very ginger conversation with Sydney Beers, who's the general manager at the Roundabout. And I just emailed and said, we need to talk about the W word. Can I come in for a meeting? And we had a long, careful talk, and ultimately she agreed that it was the right thing for the show, and we would just go at it carefully. We had a little more money because this was Broadway, and that we'd be super careful about it. And that's what we did, honestly. Neil Mazzella, who owns Hudson Scenic, was our technical supervisor. They've done water a lot, very successfully, and they're really smart about it, and we sort of worked through different ways that it could be safe. But some of the things I did are... I actually angled the floor of the river so that at the middle of the stage, it was about 3 feet deep, but it got progressively shallower as it went off to the side, so that by the time it got to the wings, it was only about 6 inches deep because we didn't need the depth over there.
Mm-hmm.
And that just kept down the volume of water and therefore the weight, because water is incredibly heavy. And even as it was, we had to have an engineer check the floor of the theater to make sure it could actually support all this water. And then they built the pool, they put a layer of rubber into it, and then a layer of steel on top of that, and then another layer of rubber on top of that. So it was doubly waterproofed with a layer of steel in there. And that meant that when once or twice the fight got a little too aggressive and the boat ground into the floor and ripped a hole through the rubber liner, the steel protected the next layer of rubber, and we actually never did spring a leak the whole time. But we were all very nervous about the whole thing.
Sure. So the river is kind of the scene, pardon the pun, stealer of the of the show. But there's also a romantic tryst takes place in a beautiful pied-à-terre in the stars. Where did mm-hmm. the vision for that lovely little apartment come from?
That, again, it came, you know, in the best way from sort of a collaboration. I spent months with both Evan Cabinet, the director, and Keith Parham, the lighting designer, who I hadn't worked with before, just kind of kicking around ideas. We had a lot of different ways. The general ideas for the show were always going to be what they were. But Keith said at one point in a meeting that one little tryst in the garret, it's that moment when early in a relationship when you're madly in love with somebody and you come up with an idea that seems like a good idea because you're in love, and it's in fact an idiotic, horrible, terrible idea, but you're too in love to notice it. And they cook up the idea of murdering her husband, and that's going to solve all their problems. And it makes sense to them because they're so in love. And it's oddly, it's the one kind of happy moment in the entire play. It's such a grim play, and Therese is such an unhappy character. But there's this one moment where she's in love, she's off with her lover, she's off in this romantic garret, and there's a line in the script where Laurent says, my apartment's tiny, there's room for a bed, but I have a skylight so I can see the stars, and I live in the stars. And we just thought it's as close as this play ever gets to sort of fairy tale happiness. So let's take this gritty little awful garret and float it in a sea of stars and let them be floating in the sky and give them that one little moment of beauty. And audience members said to me several different times that they kept wishing that we would go back to that scene at some point because it was so pretty.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of the point of it, that it's this one moment of happiness in this horrible, awful story, and you want to go back to it, and you never get to. She's always trying to get back to that moment, and she never gets back to it.
You've said a few times while we were talking that you haven't worked with so-and-so before, you haven't worked with so-and-so before, but there are a number of people you have worked with over the years. Do you like developing that shorthand when you work with like Seth Barish on Mike Birbiglia's shows or other people you work with a number of times?
Yeah, no, it's great. It's certainly easier when you have worked with someone before because you do develop a shorthand. You know, if I go into a meeting with, I don't know, James Lapine or Hal Prince or Susan Stroman at this point, we've been working together for so long that there is definitely a shorthand, and it helps me to know some of the questions to ask. And I think it also, there's just a comfort level that if you don't find the answer right away, that both halves of the conversation sort of know you will get to an answer, and mm-hmm. you don't get nervous about it. The same with Seth Barish on the Mike Birbiglia shows. Each one of them is, we come up with something different, but you don't get nervous early in the process that you don't have the answer yet because you have confidence that you'll get there eventually. It's exciting, though, to work with new people, I've got to say, because it always cracks something open in a new and interesting way. I mean, sometimes I work with someone new and it's not interesting, and that's disappointing. But mm-hmm. often you work with someone new and it just opens up something you wouldn't have thought of before. Or that's sort of the most exciting thing about a freelance career in theater to me, is that it's different every time. And I get to learn something new every time. And working with new people is always kind of, it's just interesting and exciting, and you never know where they're coming from. And there's frustrations with that, too. In fact, Evan and I bumped heads a few times on this show, but we got through it and we found a way of working together. And ultimately, I was so proud of what we did.
The Mike Birbiglia shows are one-man shows. He writes and works up and performs them, and Seth Barish directs. Is there, in your mindset, a noticeable different approach you have to take when you know there's only going to be one performer on stage?
I think so. I wouldn't say that this is always true, but certainly in those Mike Birbiglia shows, it is true that I'm trying to keep the set very simple. And the kind of shorthand we've found for the three that we've done is the set tries to be some kind of a visual image that hooks into the kind of, again, it's sort of the climactic scene of the shows. And because Mike's shows are monologues, it's mm-hmm. the climax is not quite, maybe that's not the right word for it, but in Sleepwalk With Me, the sort of climax of the story is when he jumps out the window.
Right.
And so this
set was at La Quinta Inn.
At La Quinta Inn in Waya Waya, Washington. And so the set was this huge plexiglass thing with a hole in the back of it. It looked like someone had broken one of the panes of glass. But we didn't explain it until you got to that part of the story. Girlfriend's Boyfriend, the next show we did, the sort of, again, the kind of the high point of the story is when Mike is talking about scribbling down all these notes and graphs and things on a crazy piece of paper. And I literally just took the piece of paper from him and we plastered all of those, his chicken scratch all over the walls of the theater. And it looked kind of like hieroglyphics or something. And I don't think the audience knew what the hell they were looking at until we got to that point in the story. And then suddenly it clicks and you understand that you're sort of immersed in Mike's brain mm-hmm. in that moment. And the same on Thank God for Jokes, we were trying to do the same thing, that Thank God for Jokes is sort of talking about art as religion, kind of, which is, I think, for those of us who are engaged in it, is religion is not quite the right word, but it's the thing that we worship and we devote ourselves to and that we find gives us sort of a way to understand the world. And the point of Thank God for Jokes is that, you know, you what is funny or informative to one person can be offensive to someone else. And if you tame down everything that it doesn't offend anyone, it sort of stops to have any kind of stops having any kind of an edge. And the set, and I'm not sure if this one is as successful as some of the others, but what it was trying to do was be a kind of quasi-religious space with stained glass windows in it. And then we scrawled some graffiti across it that I'm not even going to remember what it says off the top of my head, but I know there's a in there somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And we were trying to sort of show an image of a religious icon that's been defaced. And that, you know, that is both offensive and maybe interesting, and that there's a tension there. And that's sort of what the show is trying to talk about as well.
I want to hit on another thing before I have to let you go, and that is
sure.
Designing for the circus. You've designed for the Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey circuses. How does that come across your table, and do you get to just go crazy with color, I imagine, at least?
You know what's interesting? It came across my table like most things do. A director I knew was working on it and recommended me to them, and they interviewed me and said, hey, let's come join the circus. And I did it for 2 years with two different people. And you know what's interesting? It's interesting that you say that crazy color, because one of my cardinal design rules, and I learned this from John Conklin, who was one of my graduate school design teachers, and he said, if you go into a project and you're absolutely sure that it has to be white, paint it black and see what it looks like, just to see what that teaches you.
Mm-hmm.
And I went at the circus with that same thought. And I said, the one thing I know about a circus is that it has to be colorful. So what happens if we do a black and white circus? And we played with that for a while, and we couldn't sell to Ringling Brothers to do a black and white circus. But the first one I did was a set made entirely out of white plexiglass. And there, in the first few scenes, it was all black and white, and there was like a zebra act and stuff. And then there was some clown act or something that made color come into the world, and built into that white plexiglass were LEDs that could make it any color we wanted. And so that's how we got into kind of crazy circus color. But it was actually an oddly conceptual design for a relatively non-conceptual exercise.
Uh-huh.
It was fun going to work with tigers and elephants. I think they don't have elephants in the Ringling Brothers Circus anymore.
No, they don't.
But in those days, they did.
So you have a busy little bit here as a Tony nominee. And then what's next? What are you working on?
Coming up next, I'm actually back at Barrington Stage. John Rando and I are going to do Pirates of Penzance.
Yes,
there this
you
summer.
Are. Oh, that's so exciting. I didn't realize you were attached with Will Swenson starring.
Will Swenson is the Pirate King. I can't wait.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the fall, we're going to bring Bronx Tale to Broadway. We did it in New Jersey last winter, and we're bringing it into New York this year. And I'm doing Freaky Friday for Disney right now. We're developing that.
Awesome. Thank you so much for speaking with me about your work. It's been a great pleasure, and enjoy your time this summer in the Berkshires, as well as this, you know, busy theater season in New York City.
Thanks so much. It's really a pleasure to talk to you.
Scenic designer Beowulf Borat is nominated for a Tony Award for the Roundabout Theater Company production of Thérèse Raquin. The Tony Awards will take place on June 12th. Beowulf's work will be on view at Barrington Stage Company in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, when their production of The Pirates of Penzance opens next month. Links to more information are posted along with this interview at wamc.org/roundtable. I'm Sarah LaDuke, and you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.